the headlines. The U.S. House Speaker visits Ukraine and the latest show of support for the fight against Russia as Moscow hits weapons supplied by Russian nations, Western nations, that is, near Odessa. The Israeli military steps up its crackdown in the occupied West Bank following the death of a guard outside the Ariel settlement on Friday. And rallies are held across the world to mark International Labor Day, also known as May Day. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisun Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Fighting continues unabated across Ukraine as the war with Russia is in its day 67. The attacks are most fierce in the disputed eastern regions, but they have also reached as far as the city of Odessa, where local officials say a Russian missile strike from Crimea has destroyed the airport runway. No one was harmed. Moscow says it has struck a weapon shipment supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. and European countries. Meanwhile, in the southern Kherson region, Russia says Ukrainian shelling of a school, kindergarten, and cemetery has killed and injured civilians. So far, no reaction from Kiev to that. And in the Russian-held port city of Mariupol, nearly 50 civilians, including several children, have managed to leave a besieged steel plant. Ukrainian soldiers and hundreds of civilians remain holed up there. Earlier evacuation efforts all failed. The U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid an unannounced visit to Kiev, where she met President Volodymyr Zelensky. During the meeting, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
Zelensky, for his part, thanked the U.S. and its Congress for, in his own words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi was being accompanied by several lawmakers on her trip that came after last weekend's visit by U.S. Secretaries of State and Defense to Ukraine. Later in a statement, Pelosi said Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. alone has already provided $3 billion in aid, and in a major increase of such funding, President Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in mostly military assistance. But Moscow has warned that aid would only fuel the conflict and raise the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. In a retaliatory move, Moscow has warned that it may seize the Russian-based assets of countries it considers hostile. The Speaker of Russia's lower house of parliament says the proceeds from sales of these assets will be used for the country's development. He accused some countries of violating international law and resorting to pure theft. He particularly named Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, and even the United States. U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed that Russian oligarchs' seized assets are sold off and the proceeds are paid to Ukraine. The proposal is part of U.S. policies to ratchet up economic pressure on Russia over the Ukraine war. He also said that the U.S. has set a dangerous precedent which could backfire. Meanwhile, Russia says talks with the U.S. on strategic stability are now formally frozen. Moscow says contacts could resume after its military operation in Ukraine is completed. We talk about this matter with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Russia says dialogue between Moscow and Washington on strategic stability is now formally frozen. The director of the Russian Foreign Ministry's Department on Nonproliferation says that contacts could resume after Russia completes its offensive operation in Ukraine. Vladimir Yermakov warned that plans by the U.S. to deploy medium and small-range missiles in Europe will fuel an arms race and worsen the situation. The top diplomat noted the risks of a nuclear war should be kept to a minimum. Yermakov also said that nuclear powers must adhere to the agreed framework aimed at preventing a nuclear war. Tensions have escalated between Russia and the West since Moscow launched a war on Ukraine in February. Time now for some discussion and insight. So joining me will be Alfred Desaius, lawyer, writer, and historian out of Geneva. Also with us will be John Stepling, author and commentator from Indre, Norway. Now, Alfred, this is what Russia talking about, talking of strategic stability. When they did have talks, I mean, I don't remember them to come to any conclusion, anything that Russia wanted, despite all the warnings, whatever the demands, proposals they raised. Now that they're saying it's formally frozen, so what should we be expecting next?
Well, I'm still hoping for common sense to win out. Last June 2021, President Putin and President Joe Biden met here in Geneva, and I commented that meeting. I had great hopes that we in the United States would stop provoking, that we would understand that Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the United Nations Charter prohibits not only the use of force, but also the threat of the use of force. And of course, arming Ukraine to the teeth and sending missiles and heavy weapons in the area and also to Poland and other countries bordering Russia is a threat. So that is in itself a violation of the UN Charter. That doesn't justify the aggression against Ukraine, but you must put it into context. My worry is nuclear weapon, nuclear war, and my Nordic friends on the Nobel Peace Prize Watch Committee, Frederick Heffermehl, and a number of American professors, including Richard Falk and myself, signed a Nordic initiative for peace in Ukraine that has been sent to the five heads of state of the Nordic countries. Let's see whether that advances. In any event, it is a serious danger. We cannot afford the use of nuclear weapons, tactical or otherwise, in Europe. The fate of humanity that is at stake. It's not the fate of Ukraine and Russia and the European Union. It's the fate of humanity. So it must be quite clear to everybody that nuclear weapons cannot be used. And the only country thus far that has ever used nuclear weapons is my country, the United States of America, when we carried out indiscriminate bombardment of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one of the greatest crimes in human history.
Okay. Now, John, Russia is worried about this arms race, and they're also warning against nuclear war. Are they right?
I think everybody is terrified at the prospect of nuclear war. And you know, the context here, though, I think the propaganda coming from the West has to be countered a little bit, and certain things have to be made clear, because when people talk about Russian aggression, the Russian invasion, this has to be clarified. It wasn't unprovoked. If anything, Russia was faced with almost no other option but to defend the people in Donbass. And to draw a line stopping the NATO expansion right up to their borders from the U.S.-NATO war machine that has a track record of aggression. I mean, listening to Nancy Pelosi, who can't even get the name of the Ukrainian president correct. She kept calling him Kerensky. When she's talking about this, I mean, she should choke on the hypocrisy. I mean, this is the United States supported head-chopping psychopath ISIS in Syria. It murdered Gaddafi and bombed Libya back into the Stone Age. It occupied Afghanistan for 20 years. The suffering, untold destruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. The CIA has fomented coups around the world, all kinds of covert operations. And most importantly, the U.S. interfered in 96 in the elections in Russia. They openly admitted, they made a Hollywood movie about it, getting Yeltsin elected because he was going to be friendly to Western capital. And that's always the defining motive in things is a business-friendly atmosphere for Western capital. Meanwhile, of course, defense industries, you know, reap enormous profit. But the peace negotiations, you know, who violated Minsk I and Minsk II? I mean, it was Ukraine. The U.S. has been, in 2014, the second point I meant to make, right, was in 2014, the U.S. fomented a coup in Ukraine. It drove out a Russian-friendly president and replaced him with a Western-friendly president. And it also started pumping billions of dollars into Ukraine in the form of weapons and military training. Military personnel from the United States and Great Britain went in to train these far-right militias, try to put them into some kind of structured form of an actual army. And it has not stopped this funneling of incredible amounts of weaponry, and this is a military, the Ukrainian military, that is deeply infested with neo-Nazis, far-right extremism, open fascism. At one point, Russia, you know, presented 200 war crime accusations to the UN. They were ignored. In 2015, Putin asked for peacekeepers to go to Ukraine and help with the situation. They were ignored. Right. It is the U.S. that has pushed for this war. They are continuing to inflame the situation by rebuffing any kind of peace discussions at all. And now we see celebrities and influencers and all people. Angelina Jolie shows up in Kiev. I mean, the propaganda is just stunning. And it's important to try to counter that Western narrative with something resembling the truth, I think.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments and insight. Alfred Isaias, lawyer, writer, historian in Geneva. John Stubbling, author and commentator from Indre, Norway.
The Israeli military has stepped up its security crackdown in the occupied West Bank after a guard outside the settlement of Ariel was shot dead on Friday. The military says it has conducted new search operations in Palestinian villages. Israeli forces also raided the home village of the suspects behind the incident and says both suspects have been arrested. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed wing of the Fatah faction, has claimed responsibility for the shooting. The group says the attack was in response to Israeli violations in Al-Quds that injured nearly 300 Palestinians over 2 weeks. The regime forces also killed a Palestinian in operation that they claim was linked to the hunt for the attackers. And workers and activists worldwide have held rallies to mark International Labor Day, May Day. In Turkey, police clashed with protesters as they were trying to reach Istanbul's iconic Taksim Square. Over 160 people were arrested in Istanbul. Turkish protesters were angry at raging inflation in their country. That was 61% last month. That is the highest in 20 years. In France, security forces fired tear gas to disperse demonstrators in Paris. Several arrests were reportedly made. Protesters slammed the fresh government's economic policies and expressed anger at rising unemployment in the country. The demonstrators called for better working conditions and higher wages. In Cuba, people turned out in their thousands to mark May Day. Similar rallies took place in Italy and Greece, too. An explosion targeting a mosque in the Afghan capital Kabul killed at least 50 worshippers 2 days ago. Now, the Daesh terrorist group says that its operatives were behind the bloodshed. The attack drew many condemnations, including one from the UN that said attacks against civilians are prohibited under international humanitarian law. Also, on Saturday, a car bomb explosion in Kabul left one person dead and three others wounded. Several back-to-back terrorist attacks in recent weeks have raised security fears on the eve of Eid al-Fitr, a religious occasion that is celebrated at the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. A funeral procession has been held for veteran Iranian movie producer and director Nader Talibzadeh, who passed away at the age of 69 2 days ago. A huge crowd of mourners attended the funeral service in Tehran on Sunday. Talibzadeh is known for his award-winning documentaries and TV productions. He wrote and hosted a talk show dubbed The Secret for Press TV. Talibzadeh was also the secretary of the International New Horizon Conference, an annual event serving as a platform for criticizing U.S. and Israeli policies. That led to him being blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington. Talibzadeh died of heart disease complications on the 29th of April. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Zoonotic spillovers or the transmission of pathogens from wild animals to humans expected to rise with at least 15,000 instances of viruses leaping between species over the next 50 years. We have prepared for you an article written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled Potentially Devastating: Climate Crisis May Fuel Future Pandemics. The piece has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Researchers have warned there will be at least 15,000 instances of viruses leaping between species over the next 50 years. With the climate crisis helping fuel a potentially devastating spread of disease that will imperil animals and people and risk further pandemics. As the planet heats up, many animal species will be forced to move into new areas to find suitable conditions. They will bring their parasites and pathogens with them, causing them to spread between species that haven't interacted before. This will heighten the risk of what is called zoonotic spillover, where viruses transfer from animals to people, potentially triggering another pandemic of the magnitude of COVID-19. Gregory Albury, an expert in disease ecology at Georgetown University in Washington and co-author of the paper published in Nature, said, "As the world changes, the face of disease will change too. This work provides more incontrovertible evidence that the coming decades will not only be hotter, but sicker." Gregory Albury said, "We have demonstrated a novel and potentially devastating mechanism for disease emergence that could threaten the health of animals in the future and will likely have ramifications for us too." Gregory Albury said, "The climate change is shaking ecosystems to their core and causing interactions between species that are already likely to be spreading viruses." He said that even drastic action to address global heating now won't be enough to hold the risk of spillover events. He said, "This is happening. It's not preventable even in the best-case climate change scenarios, and we need to put measures in place to build health infrastructure to protect animal and human populations." Research paper states that at least 10,000 types of virus capable of infecting humans are circulating silently in wild animal populations. Until relatively recently, such crossover infections were unusual, but as more habitat has been destroyed for agriculture and urban expansion, more people have come into contact with infected animals. Climate change is exacerbating this problem by helping circulate disease between species that previously did not encounter each other. The study forecasts the geographic range shifts of 3,139 mammal species due to climate and land use changes until 2070, and found that even under a relatively low level of global heating, there will be at least 15,000 cross-species transmission events of one or more viruses during this time. Bats will account for the majority of this disease spread because of their ability to travel large distances. An infected bat in Wuhan, China, is a suspected cause of the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, and previous research has estimated there are about 3,200 strains of coronaviruses already moving among bat populations. The new research warns the risk of climate-driven disease is not a future one. The paper says, "Surprisingly, we find that this ecological transition may already be underway, and holding warming under 2 degrees Celsius within the century will not reduce future viral sharing. Much of the disease risk is set to center upon high elevation areas in Africa and Asia, although a lack of monitoring will make it difficult to track the progress of certain viruses." Colin Carlson, another co-author of the research, said, "There is this monumental and mostly unobserved change happening within ecosystems." Colin Carlson added, "We aren't keeping an eye on them, and it makes pandemic risk everyone's problem. Climate change is creating innumerable hotspots for zoonotic risk right in our backyard. We have to build health systems that are ready for that." Experts not involved in the research said the study highlighted the urgent need to improve processes designed to prevent future pandemics, as well as to phase out the use of fossil fuels that are causing the climate crisis. Aaron Bernstein, interim director of the Center for Climate Health and Global Environment at Harvard University, said the findings underscore that we must, absolutely must, prevent pathogen spillover. He said vaccines, drugs and tests are essential, but without major investment in primary pandemic prevention, namely habitat conservation, strictly regulating wildlife trade and improved livestock biosecurity, as examples, we will find ourselves in a world where only the rich are able to endure even more likely infectious disease outbreaks. Peter Daszak, president of the EcoHealth Alliance, a non-profit that works on pandemic prevention, said that while human interference in landscapes has been understood as a disease risk for a while, the new research represents a critical step forward in the understanding of how climate change will fuel the spread of viruses. Peter Daszak said, "What's even more concerning is that we may already be in this process, something I didn't expect and a real wake-up call for public health." He added, "In fact, if you think about the likely impact of climate change, if pandemic diseases are one of them, we're talking trillions of dollars of potential impact." Peter Daszak added, "This hidden cost of climate change is finally illuminated, and the vision this paper shows us is a very ugly future for wildlife and for people." According to scientists, preventing future pandemics at source would cost a small fraction of the damage already caused by viruses that jump from wildlife to people. New analysis has calculated each year, on average, more than 3 million people die from zoonotic diseases, those that spill over from wildlife into humans. Stopping the destruction of nature, which brings humans and wildlife into greater contact and results in spillover, would cost about $20 billion a year, just 10% of the annual economic damage caused by zoonotic events and 5% of the value of the lives lost. The scientists heavily criticize approaches by global bodies and governments that focus only on preventing the spread of new viruses once they have infected humans, rather than tackling the root causes as well. Professor Aaron Bernstein of the Center for Climate, Health and the Global Environment at Harvard University, who led the new assessment, said, "That premise is one of the greatest pieces of folly of modern times. It details three key actions: global surveillance of viruses in wildlife, better control of hunting and trade in wildlife, and stopping the raising of forests. These actions would also pay huge dividends in fighting the climate emergency and the biodiversity crisis. Wildlife is known to harbour vast numbers of viruses, and outbreaks are increasing in frequency and severity. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, experts have repeatedly warned that the root causes must be tackled." A talk with remarkable people.
It's a tragedy, virtually impossible for an American to see on television, to read books, to see films about the Middle East that are not colored politically by this conflict, in which the Arabs almost always play the role of terrorists and violent people and irrational and so on and so forth. The only thing they understand is the language of force. This is the principle here, that unless you give them a bloody nose, they won't understand. We can't talk reason with them.
I mean, even with the former Secretary of State, John Kerry, saying you're going to become an apartheid state, for which he was condemned by so many and he was quickly shut up. He said to Israel, if you keep this way, you're be an apartheid state. One American said this, John Kerry. He was immediately shut up. Because Israel is the exception. It always goes back to the Holocaust. There is an empirical reality of the Jewish life. They did have a Holocaust. Okay, but there were many other genocides. It was an Armenian genocide nobody ever speaks about. But they have effectively put this forth. There are living images that are always put across. There are museums all over the place. The Holocaust is something that was horrible that happened and that everybody condemned it. But the Zionists find it very useful in order to legitimize Israel. Second, you have the rise of the religious right. And both in Israel, where they say God gave them the land, and the evangelicals here, and evangelicals that were in the United Kingdom, who actually wanted to see a Jewish state in order to get rid of Jews and to bring about the end times. At a certain point, the British officialdom began also to think in terms of having a Jewish state that would be a client state in their own imperial thrust into the Middle East. And so they tended to favor it. It was very clear that the British wanted to give somebody else's land to a foreign ideological group because it seemed at that time to serve British interests. So the British gave to the Zionists Palestine, even though Palestine was under a League of Nations mandate. The British had put in the mandate the promise to the Zionists, but at the same time, in Article 11, I believe, of the mandate, it called for the British to prepare the existing population for nationhood, for statehood. They just gave the land away, even though the majority of the population were the indigenous Palestinian people.
Interplay between British domestic and imperial considerations, Jewish Zionist lobbyists and Christian Zionist prophetic politics would lead to the Balfour Declaration, which promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Then an imperial world power, Britain, gave sanction for the first time to the Zionist campaign for possession of Palestine.
Professor Chomsky, I would like to start with a word of Edward Said talking about you in 1975 in the Palestinian Review. He says, "There are men whose humanity is armed with learning with an indefatigable energy for seeking out uncomfortable truths and little-known because deliberately buried facts. So I wanted to start with this saying of Edward Said, whom you know very well.
Yes, we were a mutual admiration society.
Yes. In the text of your lecture given at Columbia at the memorial of Edward Said, December 2009, you say, "I think the greatest singular achievement of Said as literary critic has been to put imperialism at the center of Western civilization. There is an almost remarkable tendency to not mention imperialism as shaping the contours of Western civilization. In literary criticism and historical writing, there are two times, before Orientalism and after Orientalism. And my question is, in the light of Orientalism, can you explain what is imperialism?"
There are many efforts to define the term. I think we all know pretty much what it means. It means the exerting of the power of one state over the people and society of others. It can take many forms, direct conquest, harsh sanctions, current U.S. mode of imperialism. In the case in question, there has been basically a thousand-year war of the North against the global South. I'm borrowing the phrase of the eminent historian of the Middle East, William Polk. And as he points out, the war against the global South is mostly the war against the Muslim South. This war has taken many forms. The Muslim South has sought many ways to resist, accommodation, imitation, direct resistance, conciliation. Nothing has worked. The final stage, the current stage, is a kind of jihadism. In fact, Polk's great work on the subject is called Crusaders and Jihadis, reviewing this long history. But we've now, just about every imaginable form has been used. Direct aggression, occupation over and over. Yesterday we heard a new stage in the direct support for direct aggression and occupation. The U.S. government's announcement that it now will violate the judgment of the International Court of Justice, which declared all settlements, all Israeli settlements in the occupied territories to be illegal. Even the U.S. Justice Bergenthal, gave his accord to this in a separate statement. Yesterday, the Secretary of State declared that the United States no longer abides by that. So here's a case of aggression and occupation, which is officially recognized by the United States instead of merely supporting it as it's been doing all along and blocking efforts to negotiate a settlement. So aggression and violation are one form of imperialism. Brutal sanctions are another form. There's only one country in the world that is powerful enough to impose sanctions, which it does freely. That's the United States. Sanctions issued by the United States, in fact, apply not just to the state that sanctioned, but to every other country. So when the U.S. declares sanctions against Iran in order to try to destroy its economy, undermine its regime, European countries don't agree, but they have no choice but to accept U.S. orders. The U.S. essentially runs the international financial system, and countries that disobey the orders of the Godfather will be duly punished.
Then we can say that imperialism is always a domination on other people, other countries.
That's the way we use the term. So it takes the history of the United States, which is a striking case. The United States, the founding fathers described their goals of taking over control of what's now the national territory, in fact, the entire continent, as a form of imperialism. They didn't refrain from using the term. There are other forms of imperialism, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Spanish Empire. Hitler's conquests were a form of imperialism. The Russian Empire was another one. It all involves one or another form of domination, sometimes combined with much harsher crimes, even aims at total extermination.
You say, and I quote you, settler colonialism commonly the most vicious form of imperial conquest. Can you give me an explanation of your saying, especially in the context of Palestine-Israel?
Settler colonialism is indeed quite an extreme form of imperial domination. Settler colonialism not only dominates the nations that are conquered and repressed, but it actually replaces their population. It involves ethnic cleansing, extermination, replacement of the populations by the new settlers who come in and essentially take over. So the United States is a extreme case of settler colonialism. Of course, there were many millions of native people here who were driven out, exterminated. The new colonists took over their lands. Another case is Israel's entire existence. It was a form of settler colonialism. It the initial Zionist, some call it invasion, whatever term you want to use, the emigration to the former Palestine. There were, I think, possibilities for accommodation and integration, but they didn't last very long. But the formation of Israel in 1948, the conquests that took place that year left Jewish domination of most of the country, about half the country. The other half was taken over by Jordan in a tacit agreement with the Zionist movement. The Palestinian population was mostly expelled, many killed, some remained in the West Bank, the Jordanian area, a few in the Jewish area. Then in 1967, the outcome of the war was that Israel took over new territories, new Palestinian territories, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and has since been carrying out extensive further settler colonialism, establishing an extensive settlement structure. In the West Bank, Israel has moved in hundreds of thousands of settlers. It's expanded what used to be Jerusalem to about five times its size, taking in Palestinian villages. Policy has been pretty clear since about 1970, but to try to establish what will be a greater Israel, with the settled areas integrated into Israel by vast infrastructure projects. The remaining Palestinian population is segregated into small enclaves. There's almost probably 160, 170 of them now. But the Israeli settler colonial project is a striking case now, again, underway before our eyes.
Professor Chomsky, I heard you on Democracy Now, and I want to ask you about the role of Great Britain in the implementation of the Zionist project in historical Palestine.
Well, after the First World War, the former Ottoman Empire, which included Palestine, was essentially taken over by Britain and France, and they carved it up in a secret agreement, Sykes-Picot Agreement, for their own interests, not giving any attention and concern to the interests of the local population. That was irrelevant. France took Lebanon and Syria. Britain took what's now Palestine and Iraq, and created what were called mandates under the League of Nations, which in theory were supposed to lead to independence and some degree of local sovereignty, but in practice meant developed in accord with the interests of the dominant powers. Britain authorized the establishment of what was called a Jewish national home. There was some wording about preserving the rights of the native population, indigenous population, but that had the usual meaning in imperial history. In fact, Lord Balfour himself, author of the Balfour Declaration, separately stated that the interests of the indigenous population really didn't amount to much. It was somewhat varied, but effectively it supported the Zionist immigration project. The mid-1930s, there was an Arab uprising protesting the British government control and policies and the Zionist immigration. The British put down the revolt very brutally, laid the basis for the Israeli conquest that took place in 1948. So the British rule was, there are more ugly cases in history, but it was pretty unpleasant, to put it pretty mildly, and quite supportive of the basic Zionist immigration project. Incidentally, it's not that the opinions of the population were unknown. They were quite well known. Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president, sent a commission, the King Crane Commission, to do a careful study of the attitudes and opinions of the local population. And not surprisingly, they were overwhelmingly opposed to the European immigration, the Jewish immigration. Their concerns are reported in a detailed study, but no one paid any attention to them.
What are the reasons, Professor Chomsky, for Europe and USA to back up Israel?
It's kind of a mixed story. Take the U.S., which is the strongest supporter. U.S. government attitudes towards Israel were kind of sympathetic, but not overly supportive in the 1950s and 1960s. In fact, in 1956, when Israel, jointly with Britain and France, invaded Egypt, Israel took over the Sinai, they tried to overthrow Nasser. President Eisenhower simply ordered them out. After 1967, the war in which, the major 1967 war, U.S. relations with Israel changed dramatically. At that point, Israel became a highly favored client state. There's a reason. Israel had performed a major service to the United States and to its Saudi Arabian ally in 1967. There was a conflict going on, actually a literal war going on, between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, representing two different varieties of the Islamic world. Egypt was the center of a kind of secular nationalism, Saudi Arabia was, of course, the center of radical Islamism. The United States, very much like Britain before it, tended strongly to support radical Islam in opposition to secular nationalism, which was considered much more dangerous. Israel destroyed the centers of secular nationalism, a major gift to the United States that firmed up the relationship between the United States and Israel. All the way back to 1948, the U.S. military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had been impressed with Israel's military prowess and considered it to be a potential military ally of the United States in the region. That increased through the years, and Israel became recognized to be a strategic asset, as it's called, a base for American power.
Why Israel persists in this 21st century to continue its politics of colonization and its politics of destruction?
It's continuing because it can easily get away with it. It's like asking why any other power tries to extend its power and wealth. Now, they can do it because the United States provides strong support. Europe provides tacit support. The Trump administration is, of course, extreme in this case. And as long as that continues, it's hard to imagine that Israel won't continue to try to maximize its power and wealth as long as it's authorized to do so. They'll, like any other power, they'll find all kind of pretext to justify it. That's normal. But the basic facts are pretty simple.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.